Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
Two big competitors, one big goal: put humans back on the moon. You are listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. SpaceX founder Elon Musk and Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos are handling billion-dollar companies trying to send humans back to the moon. Building their empires hasn't been easy. And the clock is ticking on the United States' race to beat China back to the moon. Amidst this frenzy, can these space giants, Musk and Bezos, make their rocket dreams come true? We'll speak with Christian Davenport, staff writer at The Washington Post, about his new book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the New $1 trillion Space Race. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? There's an urgency to put humans on the moon once more, and two of the world's richest men are competing for that glory. In one corner stands Elon Musk, founder of SpaceX. In the other, Jeff Bezos, founder of Blue Origin. The two men take very different approaches to their company's methodology, but one fact remains the same. They want commercial space to take us back to the moon. Christian Davenport covers the rise of these two giants and the conflict between them in his new book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the New $1 trillion Space Race. This conversation is part of a live recording at the University of Central Florida Library's Speaker Spotlight. Here's part of that conversation now.
Chris, you've been on the podcast quite a few times talking about your books. The most recent one is fantastic. I blew through it in two sittings and was very upset that you had uncovered things that I didn't even know in it. So we're going to talk about the book. I want to talk about your reporting, but I want to start with the book before this one, because you are an overachiever. In the introduction of this book, you refer to your previous book, Rocket Dreams, which the reporting question you were asking in that book was, is the commercial space industry for real? You write, the answer is a resounding yes. And that comes in this book. Is there a moment in your reporting where that light bulb went off, where you said the commercial space industry is for real?
That's a great question. First, thank you so much for doing this and for having me back on Are We There Yet?, one of my favorite podcasts and NPR shows. And thanks also to UCF for having me. I mean, I think there are several moments where you look at what's going on in commercial space and are like, yeah, it's for real. First and foremost is if you're putting a human being on a spacecraft on top of a rocket that is owned and operated by a commercial company, then yeah. And they are flying human beings, if it's Blue Origin, you know, on a suborbital trajectory, just up and back about, you know, 65 miles or so. Or if you're putting human beings in orbit, then that's the real deal. But we're also seeing, obviously, you know, with SpaceX leading the way, so much of the national enterprise has moved into the commercial sector. I mean, starting with, you know, building a rocket and a spacecraft Dragon that can dock with the International Space Station and be trusted to deliver cargo and supplies and then astronauts there. You know, even I think people may remember the first launch of Falcon Heavy. They're, you know, bigger rocket than the Falcon 9, and Elon wanted to make a show of it, and he put the Tesla into orbit. And, you know, a lot of people, including me, I think, looked at that and thought it was, you know, maybe a little cheesy, disingenuous, you know, promoting Tesla. But in the end, actually, I thought it was, I think, and others disagree with me, that it was actually something of a seminal moment. You know, it added an image to the pantheon of space images going back to the dawn of the space age that was new and it was different. It was novel. It was revelatory. And it broke ground. And I dare say maybe even, you know, artistic. Mm-hmm. In a way.
And it's difficult to get that shot too, as you find out in the book.
As I do. Yeah. But I think all that. So that's, I think, the moment. Those are the moments. They build it up over time when they have increased capability. Yeah, they can launch these rockets. Yeah, they could be trusted to, you know, fly to the International Space Station. Yeah, they can be trusted to fly humans. And now we're seeing that paradigm, you know, grow with NASA's ambitions. Now, you know, we're talking about going to the moon under the Artemis program. It's going to be the commercial sector, i.e. SpaceX or Blue Origin, that's building the spacecraft that are going to land the astronauts on there. And those two companies get a lot of attention, but obviously companies like Intuitive Machines that have landed robotic spacecraft on the moon. So the other thing I would say too about where the light bulb goes off is that it's a broadening of the space ecosystem beyond just the base barons, the billionaires. You're seeing, you know, graduates of those companies go out and start their own companies that are not just building rockets, building spacesuits, building commercial space stations, building rovers, building mining technologies, power technologies, all of the sorts of things you need to be able to go out and settle space.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you take an intimate look behind the scenes of these companies. A lot of it is SpaceX and Blue Origin. We both know, being journalists covering this beat, that the commercial space industry is very tight-lipped, very difficult to get answers from. But you pull back the curtain and get some insight from both Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. This is a completely selfish question. How did you do it?
It took a long time. I mean, actually, the story that I think illustrates it best was going back to the first book for the Space Barons, because I work at the Washington Post. Jeff Bezos just so happens to own the Washington Post. You know, we are going to cover him without fear or favor. He gets no special treatment. I tried to get special treatment being the Washington Post reporter. It didn't work. I wasn't granted any. But I did a lot of research. And if you know anything about Jeff, you know that his grandfather meant a lot to him. And his grandfather worked for ARPA, which was founded in 1958, the year after Sputnik, the same year as NASA, and in a lot of ways was sort of a DOD Pentagon space agency in a way. Anyway, I had found a press release about Jeff's grandfather when he left ARPA to go work at the Atomic Energy Commission. And I knew he was going to be at a conference in Washington. And I went up to his press person, who had been trying to get Jeff to participate in the interview. And he could see me coming. And he's like, no, 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 don't even try it. And he said, hold on. And I showed him the press release. And the press release, again, from 1961, it had a picture of Jeff's grandfather on the press release. And his PR person, I showed it to him, and he looked at it. He's like, okay, come with me. I met with Jeff, and I finally said, look, I'm writing this book. I see you through the lens of space. I think space is your main passion. I know you maybe can't say that. You know, you're still the CEO of Amazon, but I want to write about your passion about space. And even at that time, he said, okay, I'm inclined to do it. A few months later, he did. And then it was sort of a similar thing for this book as well, just being dogged and going after him.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration, and you're listening to a conversation with Christian Davenport about the making of his book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the New $1 trillion Space Race.
The book focuses on Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. They both had very public spats with one another. Their philosophies for how they run their space companies are quite different. They've become rivals in this $1 trillion space race. Your reporting takes a very close look at them, and it shows that they have things in common too. What is something that ties these two leaders together?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because there is so much about the tension between them, you know, which is real. But the fact of the matter is, I think they both want to push, you know, the art of the possible, push innovation, technologies, drive down the cost to make space more accessible, to open up space to more people, to, you know, hurry up. You know, I think they're both frustrated with the pace of progress. They're both frustrated with the fact that we went to the moon in 1969. And our last mission there was in 1972 with people, and we haven't been able to return. I think they're frustrated with, you know, NASA's ability to innovate, the fact that NASA didn't build reusable rockets and wasn't looking to really build a moon base or to go on to Mars. A lot of that, they share that frustration and that desire to do something about it, which is why, you know, they've invested a lot of their own money into doing this. I think both Jeff and Elon believe that a large part of their legacies are going to be tied to space. I mean, it's one thing to be, you know, selling books and now everything else on the internet. It's another thing to build a spacecraft that lands NASA astronauts on the moon, which they're both trying to do, you know, to fly human beings, to be able to do that safely into space, to open up space to more people. I mean, Jeff talks about with Amazon, you know, the infrastructure for Amazon existed, right? There was the internet, there were the postal service, there was the credit cards, you could take people's money, but that infrastructure for space didn't exist. And if they could build that, and then you can build a sort of space economy on top of that, well, then, yeah, that's really insignificant.
Mm-hmm. You follow them in both your previous book and this book, and both Musk and Bezos went through a transition throughout the course of their careers and through this book. Musk became far more outward and divisive with his political views and his cash. Bezos kind of reshaped the philosophy of how he ran Blue Origin as time went on, and even went through a physical transformation, as you mentioned in the book. What role did their space ambitions play in shaping the way that they viewed the world and interacted with it?
I mean, in terms of how they view space, they both have, I think, this incredible long-term vision. Jeff in particular, right? He's talking about having space stations where humanity can live, space stations that are massive, right? Hundreds, thousands of people. He's talking about going into space and preserving Earth and all the resources on Earth, and preserving Earth as like a national park. And that 400 years from now, we will go to space for all of our energy needs. So there are sort of two questions there. One is the ambitions, mm-hmm. right? And they're so big. I mean, you have to have a little bit of an ego to say, I'm gonna go build a city on Mars. You have to have a little bit of an ego to say, I'm gonna create the system where there are thousands or millions of people living and working in space. And you have seen a transformation in both of them. I mean, they've become very powerful, off-putting to a lot of people, inspiring to a lot of people as well who see them in a certain light. I would just say that the danger of it is, I mean, particularly with SpaceX, is so much of the national enterprise is in that one company. Now, I'm not saying that to fault SpaceX, because they have been so successful, and Blue Origin has lagged behind. A lot of the other companies, frankly, have lagged behind. And if you're NASA or the Pentagon, you don't have that many options but to go to SpaceX, because they are that good and they deliver. But I know that in the government sector, they are eager to have alternatives to SpaceX. And you saw, for example, that when there was a dust up between Elon and President Trump, Elon threatened to take away the Dragon spacecraft that NASA relies on to fly its astronauts to the International Space Station. Without that, there's no way that NASA can get them there except for to maybe cut a deal with Russia to do it. I think a lot of people thought that was incredibly irresponsible, harmful, and I think Elon ultimately regretted it. But it shows sort of the power that he has and the problems of having so much of the space enterprise in the hands of just one company.
Are they as successful as they are because of each other?
That's a good question. So one of the themes actually I explore in the book is Jeff, you know, ceded a lot of the territory early on to SpaceX. They didn't bid on the cargo supply delivery contracts for NASA. They sat out, for the most part, the commercial crew contracts to fly astronauts to the International Space Station. And at one point, there's a scene in the book where Jeff says, you know, from now on, we go after everything they bid on. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to go after all these contracts. But I think there's sort of a business lesson in there where you fast forward to where NASA is looking at the commercial sector to build called the human landing system, the spacecraft that's going to land astronauts on the moon. Everyone thought Blue Origin was going to win. They won the most of the first round of the contracts. They had the national team. They had teamed up with Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Draper, and everyone thought they were going to win, and SpaceX ended up winning. And SpaceX ended up winning with its Starship spacecraft, which, you know, a lot of people looked at and be like, that's not a lunar lander. It's too big to land on the moon. Is this thing ever going to work? It has to be refueled. I mean, it was really innovative, but it was sort of questionable whether this was going to work. And what that loss forced Blue Origin to do was to say, well, they won with that innovative concept. Maybe that's what we should be doing. And they did. And they went back to the drawing board and scrapped their old proposal and came up with a lunar landing system that has reusability and being able to refuel the spacecraft and having a space tug that would go back and forth between the Earth and the moon. And it was a much more innovative design. Now it's a much more challenging design, but I think there was that influence from SpaceX and that loss in particular. And it's not often where Jeff Bezos, I think, learns like that from a competitor, but I believe in this instance he did.
Still to come, our conversation from the University of Central Florida Libraries Speaker Series with Davenport continues.
And the astronauts went to Garrett Reisman, who was a former astronaut, so one of their own, at the time working at SpaceX, and they were like, this is no good, man. You gotta fix this. This is not working out.
What other players influence the commercial space game? That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Central Florida Community Arts Symphony Orchestra, presenting Celebrate the Season, December 4th and 5th at Northland in Longwood. The country's largest orchestra shares traditional melodies, orchestral showstoppers, and more. Ticket information at cfcarts.com/NPR.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. From Central Florida Public Media, I'm Brendan Byrne. Before the Apollo program, there was Gemini. Gemini's goal was to get people up to space and keep them there for a while to prepare for trips during the Apollo missions. Gemini's goal was to get people up to space and keep them there for an extended period of time in preparation for long trips during the Apollo moon missions. During this time, 10 crewed missions flew on the Gemini spacecraft. We'll talk about Gemini and the book by Jeffrey Kluger, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, The Untold Story, next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, our conversation with Christian Davenport continues. We're talking about his new book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the New Trillion-Dollar Space Race, which gives a behind-the-scenes look at two billionaires vying for a top spot in the commercial space industry. But Musk and Bezos aren't the only ones working to get Americans back to the moon. We'll talk about the politicians and the astronauts that help get all these missions off the ground. Here's more of that conversation. We've been talking about Musk and Bezos. The book focuses on them. They are on the cover, but there is another very important character in the story that you write about, and that's Jim Bridenstine, the former NASA administrator. He was an unlikely pick to get to this position. Can you bring us back to how Jim Bridenstine became the administrator of NASA?
Yeah, so he was a member of Congress from Oklahoma, and unless you represent Florida or Texas in the House of Representatives or Senate, space doesn't get you any votes. Jim became fascinated with space because in Oklahoma, they have so many tornadoes and, you know, had seen this his whole life. And there was one in particular when he was in Congress in a city called Moore, and he went down there, was absolutely devastated by this tornado. And, you know, he was looking at, they had like 10 to 15 minutes notice. And he said, looking again at the commercial sector and the satellite technology, can't we do better than that? Can't we have better systems that would save lives? So when the Trump administration came through, they were looking for a leader, and you know, his name came right up.
He directed the agency during a pivotal time, right? The first Trump administration announced it was going back to the moon. There was also commercial crew returning humans to flight for the first time from American soil since the retirement of the shuttle program in 2011. You had a chance to interview Bridenstine both as a reporter and for this book. Did he recognize kind of just how enormous this moment and burden was on him as NASA's leader?
That first flight of humans from U.S. soil weighed on him heavily. So Jim Bridenstine was born in 1974. He was the first NASA administrator who was not alive for the Apollo 11 moon landing. His first memory of space is actually 1986, the Challenger disaster. He knows exactly where he was, and he remembers the teachers huddling in the hallway, just the devastation of that moment. And in the back of his mind, as he is preparing as the NASA administrator to fly crews for the first time from U.S. soil since the retirement of the space shuttle, you know, in 2011, almost a decade earlier. And oh, by the way, it's this guy, Elon Musk. He's got a trust. It's SpaceX. And there was a lot of tension between them. Jim is he's a very, not uptight guy, but by the rules, by the book, you know, military guy, doesn't drink at all. He worked as part of his military service to keep drugs out of the country. And when Elon Musk went on the Joe Rogan show and took, you know, this little hit of marijuana, he freaked out. I mean, he was really upset about that and ordered a safety review of SpaceX. I think behind the scenes, he was absolutely scared, as a lot of people were, about what was going to happen. And the tension was real. Was SpaceX going to be able to launch this crew of astronauts safely and bring them back, which is just harrowing.
One thing you did bring up in the book is Bridenstine's efforts to make NASA more fun and transparent and flashy. What were his motivations behind this, and how did it, if it did, help the agency during his time?
Well, I think his motivations, you know, first and foremost, I mean, he's a politician, and he's just been charged, you know, by the President of the United States, not just to fly astronauts safely to the International Space Station, but to send astronauts to the moon. And if you remember Vice President Pence, the initial timeline was going to be something like 2028. Vice President Pence stands up at a speech in 2019 and says, no, we're going to do it by 2024. So what he needed was was money. He needed Congress to fund NASA. And he wanted, you know, he's like, why don't we showcase the astronauts more? They were heroes during the dawn of the space age. And now they're sort of forgotten. I mean, if you go around today and ask people, you know, who's on the International Space Station right now, chances are they probably couldn't tell you. You know, first and foremost, he wanted money. He needed Democrat support too. And so I think that's one of the big motivations for that.
We talked about commercial crew, and that was one of the most fascinating aspects of this book to me, was some of the insight that you shined light on for the commercial crew development, specifically what was happening on SpaceX's side, because NASA and the astronauts were not on board with what SpaceX was doing, were they?
No, I mean, there was a lot of tension. One of the main points of tension was in the Crew Dragon, SpaceX's capsule, it's touchscreen. So there are some buttons and switches and some analog stuff, but for the most part, it's a touchscreen. And a first group of astronauts came down even before SpaceX had won the contract, and they're doing the simulator and they're doing it on a touchscreen. And these are NASA astronauts. So for the most part, they're fighter jet pilots, military. And a lot of them, you know, they've been flying in fighter jets. They have a stick. You know, Boeing Starliner space capsule had a stick. F-18 Hornet has a stick. You know, Neil Armstrong was flying with a stick landing on the moon. So they were like, where's the stick? And the software that SpaceX was using wasn't good because it was the first iteration. And so they went through the simulator and pretty much every single one of them, except for one astronaut, crashed. They crashed into the International Space Station. And the astronauts went to Garrett Reisman, who was a former astronaut, so one of their own, at the time working at SpaceX, and they were like, this is no good, man. You got to fix this. This is not working out. What the astronauts saw, and particularly Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken, who are the astronauts who ended up flying that first mission with SpaceX, they saw that the SpaceX guys were really good, and they got better with each iteration. So 1.0 led to 2.0, led to 3.0, and all of a sudden it started working, and it was more intuitive. Yeah, they had to learn a new way of flying, you know, in some ways a simpler way of flying. And I think they were really impressed with how quickly SpaceX's software engineers could adapt in real time and make a much better product.
Do you think that they were on board because they were going to be on board?
So I had a long talk with Doug Hurley about this. And so, yes, he was rooting for SpaceX. I think he was rooting for the underdog in a way, because now SpaceX is the dominant player. But people forget, you know, at the time, everyone thought Boeing was going to go first. Everyone thought, like, why do we even have to award SpaceX a contract? We have Boeing who's able to do this. And I think he got his competitive juices up. I mean, he told me that he wanted to beat Boeing, and he wanted to show them that, you know, these kids, they may have a tattoo and they may wear t-shirts and jeans to work and they don't wear jackets and ties, but they're really good at what they do. And I think there was a competitiveness with him to do it. Not only did SpaceX fly first, but after Boeing's first flight with Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, NASA, the Starliner spacecraft, had problems. NASA didn't trust Boeing to return the crews. And so SpaceX had to do it, which is obviously the great irony in all of this.
You do talk to Doug a lot, and I always find it so fascinating that he was on the last space shuttle and then the first commercial rocket. Do you think he understands the significance of what he ushered in with Bob Behnken?
I think he does. I think they're both very proud of it. They're so humble, you know, they're so self-effacing. I don't want to speak for Doug, but I think if you asked him that question, he would say, well, it's not about me or about Bob. This is about the team, right? This is about NASA team, the SpaceX team. And I think he would be right in saying that, but it was a significant moment. I think he is proud to have been part of the last shuttle mission and then the first, you know, mission for commercial crew. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As commercial crew is developing, so is Artemis. That's NASA's ambitious plan to send humans back to the moon for the first time since Apollo. How do Musk and Bezos fit into this story?
Well, so we're extending that paradigm of the commercial sector being, you know, at the center of NASA's plan. So both SpaceX and Blue Origin have the contracts to build the human landing system, the spacecraft that are going to take NASA's astronauts to the lunar surface and then back out to lunar orbit. So that's a really big deal. Now as to when those spacecraft are going to be ready and under what timeline. I mean, currently NASA's saying that they want to land astronauts on the moon in 2027. Doesn't look like that goal will be met, but they're obviously critical to everything NASA's doing in the Artemis program.
We talked about the commercial space race, but what's happening in space isn't just influenced by billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. What are some of the other things that are propelling the space race?
In this book, what I tried to focus on more too is open the aperture and look at sort of the geopolitical mm-hmm. aspect of what's going on. I mean, what China is doing in space is extraordinary, that how fast China has moved. I mean, they obviously have a space station in low Earth orbit that's, you know, continuously inhabited. They've operated a rover on Mars. They want to go to the moon, not just to the moon like we do under the Artemis program, but to the South Pole of the moon. They're operating large swarms of satellites for military purposes. But for me, what symbolizes their ambitions is the fact that they have put two flags on the moon. All of the American flags that were put up on the moon by the Apollo program are essentially either bleached white by the harsh radiation environment, maybe even just sort of deteriorated. So when China went, its first one was made out of composite materials that their engineers spent a year developing to survive in that environment. And then when they went up for their Farsight sample return mission, and even just saying those words is illustrative of their huge capability. Retrieving samples from the far side of the moon and bringing them back, which no one had ever done before. No other country has even been on the far side of the moon. They unfurled a flag on that mission. That flag was made out of basalt, volcanic rock from Earth. But it, obviously basalt is also plentiful on the moon. They took the basalt, turned it into lava, heated it up, and from the lava, somehow, were able to extract these threads, one-third the diameter of a human hair, and that's what they wove the flag out of. Now, you would say, why would you do that? To me, it's clear. They are showing, they're demonstrating that we can take the resources of the moon and use them for our own purposes. When we go to the moon, you're going to have to use the resources on the moon, or celestial bodies, and they're showing with that flag that that's what they intend to do, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. As you write in the book, they're very secretive about what they do. That is just what we know that they are working on in the space program, right? Chris, you spent more than 25 years as a reporter at the Washington Post. Much of that time was on the space beat. I know it's a great job. Is there some highlights or some moments that really stand out to you as, pardon the pun, stellar?
Oh, gosh, there's so many to choose from. I remember, I'll tell this story. In 2015, when SpaceX was trying to land the Falcon 9 booster, and they've been trying it, and they kept crashing, and it was at the end, and they had their rocket blow up, and this was their return to flight. It was also the presidential election was starting to heat up, and their return to flight was right around the holidays. I think it was December 22nd, and they kept scrubbing, and then finally, I gotta go. I have a feeling they're gonna land this one, and I mentioned it, my boss's boss, the head of my department, he was like, yeah, because the election's heating up, we don't have the travel money. It's the end of the year. We're just in the red. They live stream. You could do it from home. And I was like, okay. It was driving me crazy because I felt like they were going to land it. So I told my editor and said, I think they're going to land it. I should go down there. And he says, yeah, go ahead. Go down there. Buy a ticket. So I did. And I get down there. And at the news meeting the next day, my editor told his boss, well, Chris is down at the Cape Canaveral for the launch, and his boss was like, excuse me, he's where? Because I told him not to go. Anyway, they launched the rocket and they closed down all of Cape Canaveral, and SpaceX rented out that building that looks like a sail called Exploration Tower in Port Canaveral. And we watched the launch, and then we watched the rocket come back from the sky and land and a sonic boom. And it was an incredible, I mean, I'll remember that for a long time.
There is nothing like seeing those come back. And Falcon Heavy, I know you were there for that, to see two of them fall out of the sky that close to where we were standing is terrifying.
Yeah, and we're lucky getting to witness what you and I get to do, because I really do believe it is, we're gonna look back at this time in 30, 40, 50 years, see it as a historic moment. And that's why I wanted to write the book, because I feel like it transcends what I could do in my day job, that this is historic time, and to create sort of a real-time history of what I do believe is an important moment in the history of space exploration.
That was Christian Davenport, staff writer at The Washington Post and author of the new book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the Trillion-Dollar Space Race. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you got a good idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you make a great guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.